From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We tried to stay in our home, but a shell landed behind our house. We just arrived and don't know what happened to our house. We are the first ones to arrive to our village.
Thousands of displaced Lebanese returning home from the north, despite the continuing Israeli presence and an unstable ceasefire. We'll go to Lebanon to get a report. Then we'll host a debate on the Bush administration's proposed changes to the War Crimes Act. And we'll look at civil rights pioneer Victoria Gray Adams' life. She died on Saturday.
I remember somebody saying one time, well, you can't legislate love. I said, no, you can't, but you can legislate an atmosphere where love can happen.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The ceasefire in Lebanon continues to hold in its third day, but there are growing questions over how long it'll last. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, a senior Israeli military official said today the Israeli army may stay in South Lebanon for months until an international force is deployed. The Washington Post is reporting Hezbollah has rejected withdrawing from South Lebanon, but says it's open to a compromise of pulling back its fighters so long as the Lebanese army does not heavily search its bunkers and operations centers. Israel and the U.S. insist the ceasefire must lead to a full Hezbollah withdrawal from South Lebanon. This is U.N. Ambassador John Bolton.
One way or the other, the contemplation has always been that there would not be a vacuum in southern Lebanon such that the withdrawal of Israeli forces or the progress of Lebanese armed forces in UNIFIL would be conducted in a way that would not permit Hezbollah to re-infiltrate southern Lebanon.
Israel continues its blockade of Lebanese ports and has warned residents not to head south of the Litani River. On Tuesday, Israel dropped leaflets warning residents South Lebanon will, quote, remain dangerous before the deployment of international forces. Thousands of Lebanese are ignoring the threats and making their way home. This is Manar Yehra, a resident of Taiba.
We tried to stay in our home, but a shell landed behind our house. We just arrived and don't know what happened to our house. We are the first ones to arrive to our village.
As thousands return to their homes, Lebanon continues to bury its dead. On Tuesday, a mass burial was held for 39 people killed in Tyre. Earlier today, workers dug another grave there that will hold an estimated 100 bodies. Lebanon is facing a massive rebuilding effort. Tuesday, the Center for Economic Research in Beirut said repair and reconstruction costs will rise above $7 billion. The costliest repairs will be for Lebanon's roads and bridges. According to the Guardian of London, Israel bombed more than 94 roads and 70 bridges during its attack. At least 10,000 homes are believed to have been damaged or left in ruins. Last week, the Beirut Daily Star reported more than 900 small and medium-sized businesses were destroyed, causing an estimated $200 million in damage. Meanwhile, an official working on the cleanup of the massive oil spill off Lebanon's coast said Tuesday, Lebanon is dealing with the biggest environmental problem in the Middle East. More than 15,000 tons of oil have leaked into the sea following Israel's attack on a power station last month. This is Wael Maiden, coordinator of Lebanon's oil spill working group.
This is not only a problem for Lebanon, it is a regional problem. It is the biggest environmental problem in the Mediterranean Sea and is similar to the biggest oil spills around the world.
In Syria, President Bashar al-Assad discussed the Lebanon war Tuesday in his first major speech since the conflict began. Assad said Israel and the U.S. are to blame for stalling peace in the region and said Hezbollah has won a major victory.
The kidnapping of the soldiers was a mere excuse for the world to begin this aggression. But the result was more defeat for Israel, its allies, and its masters, and more entrenchment of the nationalist forces that support the resistance and the principle of resistance taking root in the hearts and minds of hundreds of millions of people in the Arab and Muslim world.
The government of Sri Lanka is drawing international condemnation for declaring that children can be legitimate targets in its fight against Tamil Tiger rebels. The declaration followed a military strike Monday that the Tigers say killed at least 61 children and wounded dozens more. UNICEF has condemned the bombing and says it believes the victims were school children attending a first aid course. The military says the children were conscripted child soldiers. A Sri Lankan government spokesperson said, quote, if the children are terrorists, what can we do? In the occupied territories, two activists with the International Solidarity Movement remain hospitalized after coming under fire from the Israeli military. Rena Klauman of Denmark and Limor Goldstein, an Israeli, were shot Friday as they took part in a demonstration in the West Bank village of Bilin. They were among a group of Arabs, Israelis, and foreign nationals protesting the confiscation of the village's farmland by Israel's separation barrier, the wall. In other news, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the Bush administration has been pressuring Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to dismiss the entire Hamas-led cabinet. Abbas has rejected the demand. Meanwhile, the chief of staff of the Israeli military is facing internal criticism after it was revealed he sold tens of thousands of dollars worth of stock within hours of last month's Hezbollah raid that captured two Israeli soldiers. Dan Halutz, head of the Israeli Defense Force, reportedly initiated the sale just as senior military and political figures began discussing Israel's response to the raid. Colette Avital, a labor member of the Knesset, said, quote, the country burnt and all that interested him was his investment portfolio. In Iraq, eight people are dead and at least 28 wounded in an attack in Baghdad earlier today. Meanwhile, new figures show last month was the deadliest of the Iraq war on record. According to Iraq's health ministry and the Baghdad morgue, nearly 3,430 Iraqis died in violence in July. That's an average of more than 110 people per day. The New York Times is reporting President Bush has privately expressed frustration about the progress of the war in Iraq and the lack of public support for the U.S. occupation. Citing participants in Monday's gathering at the White House, the New York Times says, quote, the president expressed frustration that Iraqis had not come to appreciate the sacrifices the United States had made in Iraq and was puzzled as to how a recent anti-American rally in support of Hezbollah in Baghdad could draw such a large crowd. The British government is reportedly considering an airport screening system that would include identifying passengers by their ethnic or religious background. The idea is drawing criticism from Arab and Muslim groups who claim they'll inevitably come under the most scrutiny. Some British police officials are also criticizing the measure. Ali Desai, a British Muslim police superintendent, said, quote, what you're suggesting is that we should have a new offense in this country called traveling while Asian. In Toronto, the UN's top official for AIDS policy criticized the Bush administration Tuesday at the 16th International AIDS Conference. UN Special Envoy on AIDS Stephen Lewis said the administration is practicing, quote, incipient neocolonialism by making demands on how African countries fight the disease. Lewis singled out the White House's emphasis on abstinence education. Meanwhile, former President Bill Clinton also spoke and called on Western countries to increase funding for research.
Here's the bottom line. We know how to overcome AIDS. We know how to prevent millions of needless deaths. We know it can be done with urgent, sustained, and strategic action. First, there must be enough money, of course, to fund effective prevention efforts and to treat all those who need it, and to continue the important research work on vaccines, microbicides, and all the other areas that need the research.
Here in this country, there's news of more scrutiny on video news releases, corporate propaganda that's presented as real news to unknowing audiences. The Federal Communications Commission has sent letters to nearly 80 television broadcasters asking whether they've properly identified video news releases, known as VNRs, before putting them on air. Stations face up to a $32,500 fine for failing properly to label VNRs. The FCC sent the letters to 77 stations identified in a study released in April by the Center for Media and Democracy as airing VNRs. The stations are scattered throughout 30 states and are affiliated with all the four major networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. and many of the stations are owned by some of the country's largest media companies, including Clear Channel, News Corp, Viacom, the Tribune Company, and Sinclair Broadcasting. Companies funding the video news releases include General Motors, Intel, and Pfizer. In a statement, FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein said, quote, "The public has a legal right to know who seeks to persuade them so they can make up their own minds about the credibility of the information presented. Shoddy practices make it difficult for viewers to tell the difference between news and propaganda," he said. In political news, Jack Carter, the son of former President Jimmy Carter, has won the Senate Democratic primary in Nevada. Carter will face incumbent Senator John Ensign in November's elections. And in New Jersey, the attorney general has resigned for intervening in a traffic ticket that was given to her boyfriend. In New Zealand, there's a week of mourning following the death of the Maori Queen. She died Tuesday at the age of 75. She was the longest-serving monarch of New Zealand's Maori community. And finally, Victoria Gray Adams, the co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, has died. Along with Fannie Lou Hamer, Victoria Gray Adams founded the party on the belief that the Democratic Party in Mississippi didn't welcome black participation. Gray Adams was the first woman to run for the U.S. Senate from the state of Mississippi. She was a member of the board of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Southern Christian Leadership Conference and a national delegate to the Democratic Party's National Convention in 1964, where she challenged the Democrats and President Lyndon Johnson. We'll have more on her story in the broadcast. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The ceasefire in Lebanon continues to hold in its third day, but there are growing questions over how long it will last. Negotiations are underway to form the United Nations peacekeeping force planned to back up the agreement. The UN hopes to get 3,500 troops on the ground in southern Lebanon within 2 weeks. Meanwhile, thousands of displaced Lebanese are returning home from the north despite the continuing Israeli presence and unstable truce. We go now to Beirut, to Amal Saad Ghorieb. She's a professor at the Lebanese American University in Beirut and the author of Hezbollah, Politics and Religion. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Amal, are you there?
Hello. Yes, I can hear you. Sorry.
Can you talk about the ceasefire as it stands right now?
Well, I think contrary to what a lot of people expected here, that it does seem to be holding relatively so. The main sticking point was that Israel had refused to withdraw until those foreign troops arrived, and Hezbollah had refused to stop fighting until the Israelis left. But in fact, what we've witnessed over the past 2 days is that there have been a great number of refugees who've returned to their homes, and I think therefore it's not in the interest of either side to escalate the situation.
We are also joined from southern Lebanon by Declan Walsh, who is a correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian, as well as The Independent, reported from Afghanistan and Pakistan, now in south of Lebanon. Where exactly are you, Declan? Declan, can you hear us?
I can hear you, yes. I said I'm in a town called Bint Jebel near the Israeli border.
And can you describe it to us? Describe your trip to the south of Lebanon and what you have seen.
Well, I've been staying in Tyre, which is the main town in southern Lebanon, which had been effectively besieged during the fighting over the last number of weeks. Now the roads have opened up and people are returning to their homes. The village that I'm in at the moment is one of the worst affected areas. I've just been speaking with officials who've told me to estimate that over half of the buildings in the town have been destroyed. And it's something that's very easy to see when you walk down the main street. There's hardly a building left standing, rubble everywhere, burned out cars, and a small trickle of residents. Assessing their houses and trying to figure out where their lives go from here.
Can you talk about the people who have returned or who have stayed and the stories they have told you?
Among most of the people, they say that a lot of people left after a couple of weeks of fighting. They've stayed with relatives in schools or other public buildings in the north for the last number of weeks, waiting for this conflict to be over. Now they're coming back, and really they're finding their livelihoods and their homes absolutely destroyed. And they're starting to wonder where to start from now. Having said that, you also get from people an enormous sense of defiance.
We're losing you a little bit. Go ahead.
Hi. But on the other hand, you get from people a quite amazing sense of defiance. People, particularly the Shia population, are in... Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Keep talking. It's just because of your satellite phone and our system, it's a little hard to hear, but keep on describing what you see.
People are incredibly proud of what they see as the achievement of Hezbollah in taking on what they call the most powerful army in the Middle East and defeating it. So even though, I've spoken to numerous families standing in the rubble of their homes, having suffered great loss, but they will tell you that for them this is victory, to feel that despite all this great destruction, this is a price that they think is worth paying.
In one of your pieces in The Guardian, you write about Aita Shab, the place where it all began, where the Hezbollah fighters stole across the border and kidnapped two Israeli soldiers. Can you describe that community and how people felt returning?
We arrived in Aita Shab a couple of hours after the ceasefire took effect. At that point, there were relatively few residents who had returned. Some people had been in a nearby Christian settlement that hadn't been touched by the fighting. They were largely defiant. Otherwise, we met Hezbollah fighters who were emerging from the rubble. These were people who were still, covered in dust, exhausted after a month of fighting, and they certainly had also a quite a triumphant tone. They were waving flags. They started broadcasting prayers from the mosque for the first time in 2 weeks, and they really felt that they had, if you like, started to take a place in the local mythology here, if you like, that the Israeli soldiers had tried to eject them from that town. And despite almost, as far as we could see, a blitz of bombing over several weeks, they had failed to dislodge the Hezbollah fighters from the town.
So you see many Hezbollah fighters as you travel in the south?
Yes, you do. You generally see them clustered, in the center of many of the towns. Some of them seem to be participating in the efforts to clean up southern Lebanon. Over the last couple of almost impassable due to rubble spilling over from destroyed buildings, have now been cleared. I passed through the town of Cana earlier, where we saw teams of people out with sweeping brushes, cleaning the rubble off the ground, and that's something you're seeing all across southern Lebanon. Otherwise, in areas where there is still an Israeli presence, in some points here you can see Israeli tanks in the distance moving about. There you still see, close to those points, you see Hezbollah fighters standing on hilltops, watching the Israelis very warily. Even the ceasefire certainly is holding against many people's expectations, but in some places it's a very tense ceasefire, and both sides are eyeing each other very warily, I think.
Today in the news we reported about the numbers of bodies people are finding and digging a mass grave and Tyre for more bodies. What do you see when it comes to casualties?
Yesterday, in this town, Bente Jebel, I saw two bodies being taken from the rubble and driven away by the Lebanese Red Cross. On the roads, you occasionally see Red Cross or Hezbollah ambulances, either the wounded or the dead, away from this area. So it's difficult to assess exact numbers. There's a mass burial taking place today in Tyre of, I understand, over 140 people. is what local officials told me. However, about 100 of those bodies, in fact, have been there for several weeks. The government hospital was unable to bury those people because they were afraid of being attacked by Israeli warplanes, even though the cemetery, the Mecca cemetery, is only perhaps a mile from the hospital. So now those bodies, if you like, have been in storage in a fruit and vegetable truck, a refrigerated vegetable truck, over the last couple of weeks. And now finally the authorities are taking an opportunity to bury them.
Jacqueline Walsh, I want to thank you for being with us. Writes for the British newspapers The Guardian and The Independent, speaking to us from the south of Lebanon in Bint Jebel. Also on the line with us from Beirut, Amal Saad Ghoriab, teaches at Lebanese American University. The claim by both sides that they have won, Amal, can you respond?
Yes, I think that it's really basically Olmert. I mean, the Olmert government is claiming that it's won. I mean, the rest of Israel doesn't appear to think that way, and if that wasn't the case, we wouldn't have seen this immense pressure on Olmert now. I think, you know, if we want to measure it objectively, just in objective terms, I know it's very much also a matter of perception, but in fact, from day one, Israel had laid out very high goalposts for itself, and it didn't actually succeed in achieving any one. Whereas Hezbollah, from the very beginning, had merely said it wanted a prisoner exchange. So if we measure it by those standards, I think we'd see that it was definitely tantamount to an Israeli defeat, which translated here is a resounding military victory.
And the feeling of people right now in Beirut, as people come out of shelters in southern Beirut, as people see exactly the situation.
Yes, I think it's really quite surprising because I've been watching, especially on television, the reaction of people who just sort of found out that their homes have been completely pulverized. I mean, yes, there is a certain, you know, astonishment, sadness and what have you, but there's such a strong sense of defiance and also faith in Hezbollah's pledge to rebuild for them. So I think it really, you know, is seen as something that isn't an irreversible loss. And if anything, they feel buoyed by this victory. So it's a very interesting political culture you've got in these Shiite strongholds. I think they're very, very much used to being targeted by Israel. And they're also, as I said earlier, I mean, they have full confidence that their homes will be restored. And they feel an incredible sense of pride and dignity. And I think that's really what underlines this entire conflict.
Amal Saad Ghoriab, I want to thank you for being with us from Lebanese American University in Beirut. She is author of the book Hezbollah, Politics and Religion, speaking to us from Beirut. This is Democracy Now. We'll be back in a minute. Khalif, The Scream, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the ceasefire in Lebanon enters its third day, the Middle East crisis continues to be one of the top news stories in the U.S. press. But the coverage of the conflict in the corporate media has come under criticism from some quarters. 2 weeks ago, two producers working for Fox News and Amman Jordan resigned in protest of the network's coverage. In their resignation letter, Serene Sabah and Jomana Karadzic wrote, quote, "We can no longer longer work with a news organization that claims to be fair and balanced when you're so far from that. They went on to write, not only are you an instrument of the Bush White House and Israeli propaganda, you are warmongers with no sense of decency nor professionalism. One of the two authors of that letter joins us on the phone right now from Amman, Jordan. Serene Sabah is a freelance TV producer who's worked with CNN, ABC News, Al Jazeera. She worked with Fox News for 3 years until her resignation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Serene.
Thank you.
Can you talk about your concerns? What work did you do for the networks, and particularly for the one that you resigned from, Fox?
Well, for CNN and the rest, I produced for a while. I was their unit manager, producer here in Jordan. And for Fox News, we basically handled logistical support for their operation in Baghdad. And up to the start of the war in Lebanon, we were also handling that end of the conflict. So basically, my work, I covered also the hotel bombings for them in Amman back in November. So it was basically a logistical unit manager, producer type of work.
Why did you leave Fox?
After 3 years and watching their coverage, I thought I could make a difference working with them. I could influence some of the people that are coming into the region because they've recently just come into this part of the world. I thought that I could give them an insight of how things are run here, the politics of the complicated politics and history of politics in this part of the region. But from the onset of the war in Lebanon, I was devastated at the way that Fox was handling the coverage from Lebanon in the U.S. And I felt there was bias, the slant, the racist remarks, the use of the word "we," meaning Israel. And it was just unbearable up until basically the massacre at Qana. And as a mother of three, watching the images, the raw images of children being pulled out of the rubble, and then I switched to Fox News to hear some of their anchors claiming that these little kids that were killed, these innocent victims that were killed, were human shields used by Hezbollah. And one of them, one of their anchors, went as far as saying they were planted there by Hezbollah to win support in this war. And it was unbelievable. For me, that was the breaking point. And this is when I decided, me and my colleague, Jumana, to hand in our resignation.
Did you try to have conversations with them? And though you talk about this as a sort of breaking point over the 3 years.
When I signed with Fox News, when I started working with them, I knew that they were very pro-Israel, that the coverage of the Middle East was very slanted. But I did have conversations with reporters that I worked with, and producers that I also worked with. I got to know a couple of people from management who came to visit in Amman and who went on to Baghdad. And we sort of had conversations. We never had a direct conversation regarding their coverage all in all, but they all knew what we felt like in Amman, in the Amman Bureau.
Serene, two Fox reporter and photographer, Steve Santani and Olaf Wig, look like they've been kidnapped in Gaza. Can you talk about what you understand has happened, and do you know the reporter, Steve Santani, and Olaf Wig, the photographer?
Olaf Wig actually is a cameraman. I've met Olaf on a couple of runs for him in Baghdad. He's a freelance cameraman that's worked with Fox News in Baghdad. He's a very nice man. Steve Santani, I met very briefly also on his way to Baghdad. They are both good people. They are both doing their job. I think that I don't have the details. I know what you people know, that they were kidnapped and they were taken against their will. I think if for any reason it had anything to do with the fact that they were foreigners or that they worked with Fox News, I do not know. But I believe that what happened was completely wrong, and if somebody was trying to send out a message, this is the wrong way of sending it out.
How often does this happen from your experience of covering this, the capture of these two men, the kidnapping of these two men?
Well, in the past 6 to 8 months, it has happened in Gaza and the West Bank that some foreigners were taken for 48 to 72 hours and then they were released. Some of them were taken for political reasons, some of them for financial reasons, not asking for ransom or anything, just putting pressure on the Palestinian National Authority, on the PNA, because there were delays in paying salaries of their employees. So usually things like that are not as dangerous as they are in Iraq. And I'm hopeful that these two journalists will be released eventually.
Do you know what kind of negotiations are going on behind the scenes to free them? And do you know, is there any discussion about who took them?
I have no information regarding that. And I don't think Fox News is going to discuss it with me or anybody else. I think it's just direct negotiations between Fox, probably, and the Palestinians and Israeli authorities on ways to release these two men.
Shireen Sabbagh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Freelance TV producer, has worked with CNN, ABC, Al Jazeera, and Fox for 3 years. She recently quit Fox with a letter announcing her resignation from Amman, along with her colleague, Jomana Karadze. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. And we turn now to the death of civil rights pioneer Victoria Great Adams. She died on this weekend at the age of 73, co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, along with Fannie Lou Hamer and Annie Devine. In 1964, they attempted to unseat the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party delegation during the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City. Victoria Gray Adams began her civil rights work in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where she taught voter registration literacy classes that assisted other African Americans to pass the voter registration tests. At that time, although 30% of Hattiesburg citizens were black, only 50 of them had been allowed to register to vote. Victoria Gray Adams later became the first woman to run for the U.S. Senate from Mississippi. She also served on the board of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, led by then Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King. We turn now to the documentary Standing on My Sister's Shoulders. It chronicles the vital role played by women from Mississippi in the civil rights movement. It was produced by Joan and Robert Sadoff and directed by Laura Lipson. In the documentary, Victoria Gray Adams recalls the day in 1965 that she and Fannie Lou Hamer and Annie Devine became the first African-American women to ever be invited as a guest on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. They were there to complain about election fraud in Mississippi. This is Victoria Gray Adams.
There was this long passageway down to the House of Representatives that the congressmen walked through on their way to the chambers. And we had people lined up on both sides of that passageway wearing signs that simply spoke to our reason for being there. And nobody ever said a word or anything as well. They just stood there. And every congressman that went into that house had to look at them on their way down. One congressman was later heard to say that he really had not taken the challenge remotely seriously. But by the time he had walked down that passageway and looked at all those people standing there and read those signs that they were wearing, he realized that he had to respond. When we came into the hall, there was all these bald-headed white men sitting in the chambers.
For the first time ever, three African-American women would be seated on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives.
It was such a victorious moment, walking down that aisle to our seats on the floor of the House of Representatives. But by far, the most beautiful sight for me was to look up in the galleries and see all of those black faces who had come in by busloads from Mississippi to see, to be there when we walked down the aisle.
The challenge put pressure on President Johnson to secure the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
This law will ensure them the right to vote. The wrong is one which no American in his heart can justify.
This groundbreaking legislation would greatly increase voter registration by eliminating poll taxes and literacy tests. But by addressing the MFTP's claims, it would undermine their efforts to unseat the congressman.
But I, at no time, was ever prepared to have the challenge dismissed without being heard. And quite frankly, my disappointment is much more than I can express at this time.
Despite the dismissal, it served as a warning to the nation's politicians.
They must avoid this illegal disfranchisement, and that in the future the House will look carefully at any cases where challenges are brought on these same grounds of wholesale disfranchisement of Negro voters.
This challenge and these three women changed forever the way Mississippi politics would be run.
We created an atmosphere where the needed changes, where the unfinished agenda could be done outside of a climate of fear.
What was impossible just 4 years earlier became a reality in 1968, when an integrated party was seated at the National Democratic Convention in Chicago. These Mississippi delegates, who had been previously denied a role in electing their leaders, were now a voice for Mississippi.
Victoria Gray Adams died on Saturday. That an excerpt of the documentary Standing on My Sister's Shoulders, chronicling the vital role women played in Mississippi in the civil rights movement. The documentary was produced by Joan and Robert Sadoff, directed by Laura Lipson. Special thanks to Women Make Movies here in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we turn now to a debate. 10 years ago, the Republican-led Congress approved legislation to make it a felony to violate the Geneva Conventions. The Bush administration now fears the War Crimes Act of 1996 could be used to prosecute civilians involved in the mistreatment and torture of prisoners in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo. The White House recently proposed changes to the War Crimes Act that would narrow the scope of punishable offenses. The new list would exclude humiliating or degrading treatment of prisoners. Military law experts believe the Bush administration is effectively rewriting parts of the Geneva Conventions. According to the New York Times, President Bush wants Congress to make the United States the first country to repudiate the language of the Geneva Conventions. To discuss this international issue, we're joined by human rights attorney Scott Horton here in New York, an adjunct law professor at Columbia University, and the former chair of the Committee on International Human Rights at the City Bar Association, New York. David Rifkin joins us in Washington, D.C. He's a partner with the Washington Law Office of Baker and Hostetler, served in the Department of Justice and the White House in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
It's good to have
you both with us. David Rifkin, let's begin with you. What do you understand the Bush administration is doing now with this 1996 law?
Actually, exactly the reverse than what's been claimed by New York Times, and sorry to say what you mentioned in your lead. The real effort by the Bush administration here is driven by the desire to make this law workable. The 96 law, unfortunately, tracks vague and overly capacious term of common article free. Nothing wrong with that if you're interested in symbolism. If you're interested in criminal prosecutions, which this administration is interested, we're in the middle of a war, there are people who, because they're not uniformed military, cannot be prosecuted under the UCMJ, somebody like a CIA agent or a contractor. And you cannot, because of our constitutional system, because of a void for vagueness concept, you cannot successfully prosecute anybody criminally with words like outrages against personal dignity. That's why the 96 statute has not been used once to prosecute anybody, because any prosecutor would look at it and say it's unenforceable. So all the administration is doing, instead of being supposedly animated by a desire to give immunity to people, is come up with a scheme where you can go after people, civilians, who tortured, killed, raped somebody, and bring those people to justice. It's a good thing.
Scott Horton, your response.
Well, I think whenever lawyers put forward a draft that takes a statute that's a model of clarity and brevity and propose to substitute for it something that is three times as long and filled with really quite grotesque ambiguities, we can question legitimately whether it's designed to clarify. I think the purposes that exist here are twofold. They're first to grant immunity or impunity to certain individuals, and these are mostly decision makers within the government. And secondly, it's designed to provide an okay to certain techniques which fall just short of torture that are being used by the CIA and also by U.S. SOCOM units today, and that includes techniques like waterboarding, long time standing, and hyperthermia, techniques which have been linked to severe injuries and fatalities already in the course of the war on terror. And to go back to the first, I think David's correct when he says there's been no prosecution under this statute. That's because, of course, we focus with respect to war crimes principally on service personnel. And as a matter of well-established and long-standing U.S. policy, service personnel are prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which provides a comprehensive basis for the prosecution of war crimes. In fact, we've already had more than 30 prosecutions brought since the commencement of the Iraq War, and there are a number of them, very important prosecutions, pending. So service personnel are not really covered by it. Then with respect to CIA personnel and Department of Defense civilians and contractors, there is a memorandum of understanding that was entered into by Michael Chertoff when he was the head of the criminal division that covered a series of hyper-coercive interrogation techniques and undertook that the Department of Justice would not prosecute personnel if they used these techniques, which in fact explains why there have been no prosecutions.
These techniques include...
Let me just say one thing very briefly. Let me ask my good friend Scott, and I don't know, Scott, if you practice criminal law as a prosecutor or as a defender. Do you really feel in this country you can bring criminal charges and get an indictment but also a conviction for somebody for, quote, committing outrageous against personal dignity? Can you think of any other criminal statute that includes such ambiguous and capacious words?
I think it would depend on the acts that are charged, but in this case, outrages against personal dignity is hardly the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter are very specific techniques that are being used, which is to say waterboarding, hyperthermia, long time standing. And under the heading of offenses against human dignity, I think what would really be called into question are, you know, formally approved sexual humiliation techniques, which have been applied, were used in Guantanamo, were also used in Iraq, and in other places. They clearly violate Common Article 3.
Scott Horton, and David Rifkin, we're going to come back to this after break. Sure. Stay with us. Noy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest, Scott Horton, adjunct law professor at Columbia University, former chair of the Committee of International Human Rights at the City Bar Association, New York, and in Washington, D.C. We're joined by David Rifkin, who served in the Department of Justice and the White House under Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Washington Post piece just a few days ago, the Bush administration's drafted amendments to a war crimes law that would eliminate the risk of prosecution for political appointees, CIA officers and former military personnel for humiliating or degrading war prisoners. This according to U.S. officials in a copy of the amendment. Scott Horton, and you were talking about sexual abuse.
Right. I think that, you know, we're really coming to a focus here on common Article 3. And, of course, the Supreme Court in its Hamden decision handed down a little bit more than 6 weeks ago now made clear that common Article 3 did apply pretty much across the board here. And I think that's one of the things that has spurred the administration to put forward this legislation.
And for us mere commoners, again, common Article 3.
Common Article 3 is a sort of mini convention within the Geneva Conventions. It applies to people other than prisoners of war. It creates a sort of humanitarian baseline, as it were, providing a minimum standard of conduct. And I think, as David Rifkin has pointed out, there are a number of terms in here that this legislation, this draft or proposed legislation, is attempting to define down.
David Rifkin.
A couple of things. First of all, I would suggest we all keep our cool until early September, once the administration formally introduces the legislative proposal, and we'll be able to read. There have been a lot of drafts floating on Washington, but I think, Scott, in good faith, we should all wait and see what it introduces. I think you'll find the range of offenses, the definition of offenses, to be quite robust. Point number one. Point number two, and this is a fundamental divide between human rights lawyers, whom I greatly admire, international law aficionados, whom I greatly admire, and criminal prosecutors. Bottom line is this: the terms used in provisions like Common Article 3 and permeate almost every international instrument are not the terms that can give rise to successful prosecution in United States district courts. Because, again, in the context of our constitutional system, particularly when you're dealing with criminal prosecution, you have to define terms with great deal of precision, great deal of specificity. If you do not, you run the risk that your charges would be thrown out or the jury would not convict the defendant. And that is the reason, again, the notion, to me, it's topsy-turvy. The notion that the administration is doing it to protect somebody. They actually want to prosecute people. And they have, as Scott himself pointed out, the administration has an excellent track record. We have nothing to be ashamed of. This administration and this country has prosecuted more people more aggressively for violations of laws of war, which unfortunately happens in the best trained military than any other military, including the British in Northern Ireland. And they have not been as successful prosecuting contractors because we all know that UCMJ, that is very well defined, well structured definition, doesn't apply. So this is the effort to actually go prosecute some people, not to give immunity to people. But let's reserve judgment on that. Let's wait and see how things read. And last thing I would say, this is only one aspect, one tool available to the government. And I've had a lot of debates, particularly with the Europeans, about they're anticipating that things like Scott mentioned sexual humiliation, like putting underwear in somebody's head, may not be chargeable under this new statute. I don't know if it is the case or not, but let's say that it isn't. Doesn't mean that people cannot be prosecuted administratively. And with all due respect, while I certainly don't condone putting women's underwear in people, isn't there a fundamental difference between that or forcing somebody to eat pork when it's against a person's religion? Offensive, to be sure, but not the same as rape or murder or torture. And again, in criminal prosecution, every prosecutor knows that if you overcharge the person, if you simultaneously charge the person with murder and spitting on the sidewalk, chances are very high that your jury would be disagreeable and would may acquit the person on all charges. So people really do not understand what is driving this definitional exercise and don't understand that there are other ways to punish people who engage in degrading and humiliating behavior.
Scott Horton.
Well, I think one thing, I agree with several of the things that David just pointed out here. One thing that we should all focus on is that this is an American criminal statute, and discretion in bringing charges and in prosecuting is going to be exercised by American prosecutors. And as is usually the case, prosecutors bring a charge when they believe they've got a strong basis to do it, and they're going to get to a conviction, which means that there are all sorts of things that they very well might not prosecute. And in a case like like this, dealing with Common Article 3, we've got to deal with the fact, of course, that the president made a determination that Common Article 3 did not apply. Of course, officers of the government may very well have relied upon that. That makes it less likely that prosecutions will be brought. I really think, you know, the focal question comes down to much less one of the actors on the ground, the interrogators, military, CIA, and others, and it comes to much more a question of the policy makers, and that's the area where the real exposure exists here.
You mentioned, Scott Horton, that you are bringing more prosecutions. What? And would this change in a War Crimes Act in this country change what you do?
Well, I don't bring other prosecutions. I mean, in fact, my involvement in criminal law has been mostly on the defense side. You know, I have studied them all around the world. And of course, war crimes are different from most of the balance of criminal law because they're subject to a potential exercise of universal jurisdiction. We have seven significant countries around the world that embrace and apply the universal jurisdiction statute. There have already been prosecutions brought in at least two countries I can think of, Belgium and Germany, relating to the war on terror, focusing on American officials, and I think it's safe to say that there will be future prosecutions of this sort. Of course, this is something that is beyond the scope of the debate now about the modification of the American War Crimes Act.
David Rifkin, I have a question. In the changes that the administration would like to make to this 10-year-old law, the War Crimes Act, it includes excluding such practices as forced nakedness, use of dog leashes, wearing of women's underwear seen at Abu Ghraib. I remember at the beginning of the invasion when I think it was Donald Rumsfeld was saying that it was a violation of the Geneva Conventions for showing photographs of prisoners if they were American. Now we're talking about these other practices. So if an American was taken hostage and was made to go naked, was put on a leash, you don't think that this law should apply?
Let me say a couple of things. First, again, we have to see how the language reads. Point number one. Point number two, I can assure you, despite what I said, there will be nothing in the legislation that condones or legitimizes infliction of degrading measures on somebody. Point number three, look, to me, frankly speaking, we should do a variety of things that produce humane treatment, primarily because of who we are as a society. So I personally do not condone torture, certainly no degrading, humiliating treatment. With all due respect, the notion that we should be doing it, as you seem to suggest, because of concerns about reciprocity, facts don't bear it out. American soldiers have not gotten Geneva-level protections in any war in which we've been involved since Geneva Conventions were adopted. Kind of Korea straddling the fence because, of course, Korea happened after the conventions were drafted, but before they were ratified by many countries. Not in Vietnam, not in Kosovo when we have a few soldiers captured, not in First Gulf One. And look, if I were an American soldier, and I know what happens to soldiers who are being captured by jihadis in Iraq and Afghanistan, who are being tortured, and I mean tortured in a medieval way and have their throats cut, and the choice was between that and being paraded naked. Sign me up. I'll be paraded naked. I would vote for Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo before enduring those type of treatments. So let's not pretend that we're talking about protecting our soldiers. That does not mean that anything goes. We have to provide the level of protection that's required by international law and, frankly, by human decency. But I'm really, frankly, very impatient about the argument, gee whiz, let's protect GIs. The GIs haven't been protected at all. And the really thing that the likes of jihadis would be swayed by the intricacies of compliance with Common Article 3, when they reject any repeat, precept of international law of war is something that doesn't apply to them because it's too Judeo-Christian? Come on.
Scott Horton.
Well, I think the Geneva Conventions were initially adopted in 1864, and certainly the United States has gotten the benefit of those conventions and
not
the tradition that they started. That's the latest iteration, of course, has gotten the benefit of those conventions and wars for decades. I mean, certainly the First World War, certainly the Second World War, it mattered a lot to American soldiers. In fact, my mentor described to me his internment in the Second World War and said he was sure he would have been killed had it not been for the Geneva Conventions. What we're doing is we're trying to establish principles that govern the conduct of nations particularly. And I think, of course, it's true true that we're now dealing with criminal bands that don't give much attention to niceties of international law. But we established these traditions to set out who we are and the values we live by, and also to establish the rules of play for interaction with other nations in the future. And we have to be thinking about conflicts that are coming down the road in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years.
The Uniform Code of Military Justice applies to the military. This would apply to Bush administration officials. It would apply to the CIA. Why now?
It would not apply to anyone other than uniformed members of the armed services. So the Uniform Code of Military Justice is just uniformed service personnel. It does not apply, for instance, even to Donald Rumsfeld or Stephen Cambone or to people in the White House. So it's, you know, the War Crimes Act that spreads the application of the Geneva Conventions the next level up to civilians, and particularly to civilian policymakers. And I think here, you know, there's a specific focus really on policymakers, and the prosecutorial focus in applying the War Crimes Act, I think from the beginning, was intended to provide deterrence at that level. So we're not really talking about soldiers in the field.
Let me just
right. That's the Uniform Military Code of Military Justice. But this would apply to Bush administration officials, to CIA.
Absolutely.
Can I just inject one factual observation? I honestly don't think that Scott would disagree with me. Things worked until after World War II. Scott, you know as well as I do, not just the jihadis, the Serbs who took two American soldiers prisoners, didn't torture them, but certainly humiliated. The Saddam's military in the first Gulf War tortured and actually raped at least one female aviator. We're dealing with rogue states. We're dealing with people who would not be bound by any respect for the rule of law. Again, my point is not that we should not emulate them, God forbid, but let's not pretend that what we're talking about is something that would protect our soldiers. We should structure our behavior entirely unilaterally, driven by our respect for international law and our own morality. But let's not pretend, again, that we're going to impact the guys we're fighting.
But that issue of, is the Bush administration running scared right now before leaving office to change this 10-year-old law? Let me ask Scott Horton
that question.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, it's very, very clear that there are not going to be any prosecutions brought by this administration, by this Justice Department. And I think the quick movement on this comes from two things. One, very, very clear ruling in Hamden by the Supreme Court recognizing the application of Common Article 3 and discussing it. Two points, in fact, in Kennedy's opinion, the criminal law implications of this for those on the American side. And secondly, realization that the Bush administration will not be at the helm of power forever. In fact, of course, Bush cannot run for re-election.
Scott, with all due respect, you're vastly overreading Hamdan. If you read it carefully, all Hamdan opinion does is incorporates Common Article 3 through the medium of UCMJ for one narrow purpose, the composition and functioning of military commissions. The court did not find that Common Article 3 applies across the board, nor could the court ever find such a thing, because in this country, courts do not issue broad advisory opinions. They're dealing with specific cases and controversies in the context of a case that was given to them, and none of those issues were before the court.
Scott Horton, last word.
Well, I think that's absolutely technically correct, and it's nevertheless also true that the Supreme Court told us very clearly how they will view this question and that they will apply Common Article 3.
They didn't even reach the question of
what
the convention is.
We're going to have to leave it there. Scott Horton, thanks for joining us. Former chair of the Committee on International Human Rights at the City Bar Association, New York, and David Rifkin, joining us from Washington, was in the Department of Justice and the White House under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdulkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, John Randolph, Jerome Bourgeois, Julian O'Connor, Megan Whitney, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Angela Alston. Our website is democracynow.org, and you can go there and sign up for our headlines and news stories every day. You can also get our headlines in Spanish and audio, as well as in transcript form, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.